And I think markets are having great difficulty trying to actually assess this. They are behaving as if this war is going to be over tomorrow. Perhaps if it never happened, perhaps it's all in our imagination. But it is actually very, very serious, because what hope have we got for the future of our fiat currencies? The answer is they're on the deathbed. And the war in Iran has just basically brought the day of the collapse of the fiat currency system just closer.
Alistair McLeod, author of the McLeod Finance Substack. Thanks for joining me. Welcome to The Competent Investor.
That's my pleasure, Tom.
Alistair, you know, it seems like the, let's say, the concentration or the amount of financial problems coming into the war, which has been going on for almost a month already, you know, if we look at the problems that existed before the war started, it seems like there were some major things that are coming to a head here this year already. So let's start by talking about, let's say, what were the biggest stresses on the financial system in your mind just coming into the war that is obviously going to put more stress on many of these already exacerbated situations?
Yeah, I think you could probably look at this from two points of view. First of all, if you look at the government finances, the only reason that the US, the UK, other G7 economies were not in recession was because of all the extra credit being pumped into the economy by governments in the form of deficits. It was deficit spending that was keeping the whole thing going. Now, that's a very, very unhealthy situation. So I think that's the first thing. The second thing is that I detected that the value of commodities priced in gold, which is real money, basically had fallen to very, very low levels, which suggests that a basket of commodities, whether the basket is of precious metals or raw materials, other raw materials, agri-products, whatever. I mean, they were being valued at roughly 20% of their long-term value. Now, that tells me that there is a bull market, if you like, in commodities, an underlying bull market in commodities, which also, incidentally, included oil and other forms of energy. Now, that was already the situation. I think the Iran situation has just hastened the speed at which commodity prices as a whole are going to rise over 2026 and bring forward the inflationary consequences. And by the inflationary consequences, I mean the effect on consumer prices and so on and so forth. That effect is going to be very, very pronounced. And I think markets are having great difficulty trying to actually assess this. They are behaving as if this war is going to be over tomorrow, perhaps if it never happened. Perhaps it's all in our imagination.
Yeah.
But it is actually very, very serious, because the consequence of energy in particular driving up prices, but also that underlying shortage in low valuation, if you like, for other commodities, the consequences of that obviously will drive up consumer prices substantially, which in turn, as we saw in 2022, post-COVID, will also drive up bond yields. And we are in a situation where government debt is already unsustainable. And to have, say, 10-year bond yields in excess of 5% basically ends up collapsing the whole fiat currency system. That has been brought forward by this unfortunate war in the Persian Gulf. So I think that's the sort of framework I think we've got to look at over the rest of this year.
I mean, there's so much to kind of pick up on there, Alistair, but when we think about the amount of debt alone being issued by the U.S. this year, for example, I mean, this obviously extends to more countries than the U.S., and I think we can get to that, but you know, I read a couple different articles concerning the idea that the U.S. has more debt than ever to have to roll over and sell this year. How does, you know, this stress being brought forward on those, you know, not only commodities, but adding this overhang of debt? Some of it was issued by Janet Yellen, some of it is issued by the new Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent. You know, this seems to be creating a very stressful situation in the bond market. And of course, the Fed is there to kind of mop up any of that excess debt. Is that going to be, you know, the buyer of last resort in this situation?
Well, it is certainly a very, very unfortunate position for the US Treasury to find itself in. I mean, we're talking about rolling over roughly a third of the outstanding debt. I mean, the problem really with past funding practices is that not enough attention has been paid to the average maturity of the debt. Mm-hmm. It has really come shorter and shorter. And this year, you're looking like rolling over around about 10 trillion out of a 38 trillion figure, so 39 trillion. So, and of course, you've also got the extra debt for the current fiscal year, which runs to September. We're about, what, halfway through it, just over halfway through it. The problem is that if the US economy is understood to be contracting, I'm talking about the private sector economy, if it's understood to be contracting, which it already is, because it has only been sustained by, if you like, excess government credit being injected into the GDP number, then quite clearly the US is in a debt trap. And the problem with a debt trap is that there is no level of bond yield which will fund the outstanding debt. And here we are with over 10 trillion to fund in this current, in 2026. It is an impossible situation. We had a similar situation in the UK back in the 1970s. And we saw medium-term gilts, which, you know, are the UK's government bonds. The yields there rose to over 15.5%, 16%. Just imagine what that would do. I mean, when we had that level of bond yields in the UK, the level of government debt to GDP was in the order of about 40, 45%. Now, we're looking at just over 100%. In the US at that time, again, it was around about, I think it was something like 30%. Now you're looking at about 120%. This is this is an untenable situation. Mm-hmm. And to have this oil disruption, oil supply, energy supply disruption driving up global prices for all tradable commodities is an extra problem, which it is impossible to find a way out of. As regards the Fed's role in this, the Fed has a very difficult choice to make. I mean, we're looking at conditions which inevitably, without the Fed's interference, will lead to an economic slump. That cannot be permitted. Why? Because the policies which decide what the Fed does are inherently political policies. Now, I know we've got a new Fed chairman coming in next month, but you know, it's going to be driven by politics. It always has to be. If you get the economy looking like it's going to really fall apart, and you've got a real crisis on your hands, and you're going to have massive unemployment and all the rest of it, if you don't do anything about it, then what does the Fed do? The Fed is tasked, if you like, with injecting sufficient credit into the economy so that the economy doesn't tank. So what you're going to see is QE on a scale you've never seen before. And already, if you look at the way the Treasury is funding itself, it is increasingly funding itself through T-bills. In other words, the debt is becoming more like cash every day, as opposed to long-term debt, which gives you the stability, if you like. Long-term debt does give you stability. But if you're going to be funding predominantly out of T-bills, then You know, this is cash for cash, which, of course, undermines the purchasing power of the dollar extremely rapidly. And I think you would probably sum it up by saying that as this crisis unfolds, there are only two possible outcomes. The one is that government stands back and everything falls apart and you have a slump, a depression. And we assume that Joseph Schumpeter's dictum of, you know, allowing the markets to sort of, if you like, sort themselves out, you know, that's one option. Mm-hmm. The other option is that the Fed tries to stop a depression and consequently degrades the value of credit, devalues the value of the dollar. Either the dollar takes it on the nose or businesses and people take it on the nose. We know which way the politicians will insist.
Well, and of course, it ends up ultimately being the people and the businesses that end up shouldering that burden either way, right?
Well, and absolutely. But I mean, the point is that people don't understand that. What they do understand is, hell, I've lost my job.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's really what drives the political motivation, which, I mean, it was interesting because recently I did quite a lot of studying on what happened in Germany between following the First World War. And the amazing thing is that a lot of the people in charge had a far better grasp of economics than anyone in today's governments and central banks. I mean, you know, the Keynesian revolution hadn't even occurred. There was a guy called Karl Helfrich who had the same standing, if you like, in terms of economic credibility as Keynes did in the 20s. And yet, you know, certainly during the war and then in the early days, he was a very influential figure presiding over the collapse of the mark, of the Reichsmark. He knew what he was doing. But what that tells us is that despite the fact that he knew what was happening, he couldn't stop it. He couldn't stand in the way of what's happening. And in fact, he put together the initial plan to recover from the collapse of the currency. So, you know, today we have a situation really where governments don't have that knowledge at all. The economic community has got no idea. They're all macroeconomists, and macroeconomics is a non-science. You know, they believe in Keynesian stimulation. Yeah, but look at it. It's stimulating and stimulating. Where are we going? We're going to hell in a handcart. You know, these guys just don't know what they're doing. And these are the guys who will advise government, and government won't listen anyway. So what hope have we got for the future of our fiat currencies? The answer is they're on the deathbed. Mm-hmm. And the war in Iran has just basically brought the day of the collapse of the fiat currency system just closer.
Which in some respects, or let's say some circles, some people might prefer, right? Let's get the pain over with, let's deal with it. And whether it ends up being some type of a reset, let's do that and move on. But, you know, going back to your previous point, Alistair, about the idea of having some type of economic slump, that, let's say, ends up assuming that we're measuring that accurately and reporting it accurately. And even by, let's say, the Fed or the Bureau of Labor Statistics' own metrics, that has seemingly become a moving goalpost, if you will.
Yeah. Well, you kept on breaking up there, but I think I got the gist of what you were saying. You know, if we're in a slump, you will bloody well know we're in a slump, whatever the numbers say. So I think that's the point I would make. But there is an underlying point here, which I think is very important to grasp, and that is that GDP, which we're, you know, governments say, you know, growth in GDP is the objective. That is the thing. You've got to get GDP growing. They don't actually understand what they're saying. GDP is no more than the amount of credit in the economy. It doesn't tell you what that credit is actually doing. If that credit is just, you know, pissing out of the tent, as it were, it's of no good whatsoever. Government can inflate the GDP figures as much as it wants and say, there we are, we've rescued the economy. Meanwhile, on the ground, the situation will tell a very, very different story. Mm-hmm. I mean, just look at it this way. If we go back to the German post-World War I experience, when money supply increased hugely, the amount of money in, or the amount of Reichsmarks, if you like, that made up GDP, expanded hugely. Was that a healthy economy? What's it hell is like? If you're going to get a hyperinflationary collapse, then by definition, measured by GDP, GDP is going to be off the charts. Of course it is. But, you know, your problem is that one unit of GDP, i.e. a Reichsmark or i.e. a dollar, will buy nothing. Mm-hmm. So, you know, this is, don't look at GDP. It's totally misleading. Governments look at it all the time. That's the only thing that matters to them. Economists today, it's the only thing that matters. We talk about growth. What? Growth is completely the wrong word. You should be talking about economic progress, not growth, because what they mean by growth is growth in the amount of credit in the economy, irrespective of whether that credit is good or bad. And by good or bad, I don't just mean you know, credit which you know is going bust, but I mean credit that is deployed without increasing production, which is actually what government credit injected into the economy does. It doesn't increase production at all. It just inflates the numbers.
I was going to say productive capacity x government spending.
Yeah. Well, it's a bit more than that. Mm-hmm. Because you've got zombie companies and all the rest of it, companies which have taken on debt, which is unproductive. They should be going to the wall. They will be prevented from going to the wall because of the unemployment mandate or the employment mandate. That's what the Fed will do. And everyone else in the G7 will be doing exactly the same thing. They will be following the same policies. But it just destroys the currencies. And, you know, this is why, you know, the impact of the Persian Gulf War on the prices of all commodities is just going to hasten the end of the fiat currency system.
So, Alistair, to add another dimension to this debt trap idea, with the hastening or the bringing forward of much of this financial stress, obviously energy prices are, let's say Japan, for example, a country that is highly dependent on oil imports, energy imports. Could this lead to them selling U.S. treasuries as one of the largest holders of U.S. debt in the world? And what would this, what exponential layer would this add to the stress of the U.S. treasury market that already has that major overhang of short-term debt that needs to be matured and sold this year?
Well, it's certainly not going to help. I wonder, I mean, one aspect of the Persian Gulf War is that the conflict between America and China is increasing, in effect. So I wouldn't be surprised to see the Chinese accelerating the selling of their treasuries. They certainly won't participate in a new round, if you like, of investing in some of the $10 trillion that's going to come through. This, of course, assumes that the U.S. Treasury will allow the transfer of stock to actually occur. That's something they may prevent, which actually would just about kill the dollar off completely. But anyway, you never know. I think the other thing we've got to think about is that Japan has been the larger exporter of capital in the G7. And, of course, America has benefited hugely, both through direct investment by U.S. pension funds and insurance companies, and also by virtue of the carry trade on the back of ultra-low Japanese interest rates. So, that, I think, is coming to an end as well. I mean, Japan depends for something like 90% of its energy on Gulf oil and gas. So it's being affected very, it's being hit very, very badly by this crisis. Last time this happened, again, going back into the mid-70s, I think I'm right in saying that the effects on Japan's inflation was to drive it up to somewhere like 13 to 15%. This is worse, this one. It really is. I mean, we only had a small, like a 10%, less than 10% decline in available oil, you know, when you had the sort of the OPEC strike. Admittedly, it drove the oil price up something like 300%. But this time, the effect is actually far larger. And also, unlike in the mid-1970s, the level of downstream production, you know, in the form of petrochemicals and all the rest of it, fertilizers, sulfur, sulfuric acid, phosphates, and so on, all that sort of stuff, there was very little coming out of the Gulf. That, all that's developed since. So we're looking at something which is really far worse than the 70s experience. And just think what that's going to do to, you know, Japanese interest rates. I mean, you know, so what does that do to the carry trade? So, mm-hmm. you know, in a roundabout way, I'm sort of answering your question from the rather simplistic approach that, you know, America, we're very friendly with you, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But quite frankly, we can't afford to buy your debt. But it is worse than that because of the geopolitical element. You know, that I think is going to get worse before it gets better. Mm-hmm. I can see that the Gulf situation is going to continue and continue. America is obviously backed down. I mean, you know, literally a day before this is being recorded, President Trump decided that to extend the but still blockade. But I mean, he wasn't going to suddenly, you know, drop all America's bombs on Iran. That's been postponed because it was quite clear that Iran would retaliate and retaliate massively, absolutely massively. So that's, he's been advised against that. He can't do anything, but he doesn't know how to back out of this. Oh, let's pressure them into meeting in Islamabad. What do the Iranians do? No way. You know, you got a problem, Mr. President. You know, you resolve it, just back off. That's their approach. And of course, ahead of the midterms, Trump finds it very, very difficult to do that. There is, and I think this geopolitical issue is just going to get worse. I mean, I'm just awaiting the moment for a Chinese ship to go through the American blockade and into Hormuz. I mean, what do the Americans do? They've got no option but to just stand back and let it happen. So everybody else gets blocked except China. You know, you can see how that's going to go down at home, as it were, in Washington or Pentagon or wherever. So now they've got themselves into a frightful mess. There is no quick resolution to this. The longer it goes on, the more people will realize what the problems are. And for goodness sake, we have equity markets hitting new highs. I mean, it's complete lunacy. The reason they're hitting new highs is because there's an awful lot of credit around, which is going straight into stocks. You know, that's really what's keeping the market buoyant, not wonderful fundamentals and, you know, the economy's going gangbusters. No way. No, it's just all, it just reflects excess credit. So it's a mess, Tom. It's an absolute mess. And this is why I tell everyone, just get the hell out of it. I mean, don't go down with the ship. It's just nonsense. Get out of credit. And the only thing you can do is to get into real legal money without counterparty risk, which is gold. And in some jurisdictions, maybe silver.
But before we get to that, Alistair, you know, because there's a lot of interesting dynamics in the gold and silver markets too. But, you know, in the oil market, we're seeing, let's say, a $90 Brent price and something like, I saw a report that it was $285 a barrel paid by Sri Lanka to get physical delivery. So how does that oil disparity, you know, that price disparity resolve itself in the world? Is the Brent, at, let's say, Western pricing, highly manipulated at this point?
Well, I mean, ask the White House. I think that's part of the answer. They seem to know what's going to happen tomorrow with uncanny accuracy. No, to answer your question properly, I mean, those of us in the stock market, those of us, you know, sort of, if you like, in looking after our investments and all the rest of it, know that, you know, the price, let us say, of NVIDIA or General Motors or whatever it might be, that is a market price. We can accept that price as the correct value at that particular moment in time. Mm-hmm. We know that because every share transaction that's done goes through the market and it becomes part of what makes the price. With commodities, it's different. Very little of commodity transactions actually go through the market. What they will do is they will tend to use the market price as a reference point, but it doesn't go through the market. So that leads to the sort of situation which actually all the time you find that the price of, say, you know, whether it's oil or gold or gas or copper or whatever, is different here from here. And it's different over there. And it's also different depending who the buyers and sellers are. It's also different based on the availability. You know, if you're prepared to wait for 6 months for it, then okay, they'll price it off the yield curve, you know, off the futures, whatever, whatever. They may well do that. But that, of course, is subject to the negotiations between the two parties. This doesn't go through the market. So what we're seeing really with the Sri Lankan thing, which HSBC reported, and I saw that it was actually reported in the Tamil Guardian, which is the local Sri Lankan newspaper. Yeah, you're right. I mean, oil was bought by Sri Lanka, obviously desperate, at something like $286 a barrel. How much? I don't know. When the settlement is, I don't know. If they needed it like tomorrow, then I can see them paying a huge rate premium. If they didn't need it, say, until 3 months' time, then they could actually have gone and dealt with someone somewhere closer to the three-month sort of price, delivery price. And the whole of the oil market is in massive backwardation. The highest price is for delivery today. And as you go out, it just goes down, 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 down. I mean, if you're looking at about a year out, I think it's something like, you know, with WTI at about 90, you're looking at about 82, I think, delivery in a year's time. So, you know, it just shows really the difference between how stock markets work, which is what we're used to, and how commodity markets work. And quite frankly, I think unless you are a specialist analyst covering commodities, very, very few people in the investment community actually understand this. Mm-hmm.
Before we leave this idea of how, let's say, how the world is transacting in this extremely important commodity, you know, the idea of the petrodollar was something that had so much strength here for the last, what would it be? I guess five decades.
It was from 1973, implemented in January 74.
Yeah. So yeah, almost 50 years here. So do you see this as a catalyzing moment for the petrodollar weakening because of the US's role in this? Or is it possibly a almost transitionary point to become the petro gas dollar because of the world, you know, sending all those VLCC tankers to the US to be able to supply much of the rest of the world?
Well, the pricing for most of the world will still be in dollars. Of that, I have absolutely no doubt. Mm-hmm. But the original petrodollar agreement was put together by Kissinger and Nixon, along with King, I think it was King Saud at the time. And in those days, basically, OPEC was Saudi Arabia. Sheikh Yamani basically ran the whole show. Mm-hmm. They got the agreement. Basically, it was clear that America had lost control over the price of oil. They accepted that and they said, right, okay, well, we accept that. But what we insist is that you price your oil in dollars and OPEC prices oil in dollars. Now, what that means is that when you sell your oil, you sell it for dollars in a bank account in an American bank. And that meant that even though the price expanded, you know, rose quite sharply, it really led to a massive increase in the amount of dollars in circulation. The other side of that was that because the US was trying very hard to retain political control over the entire Americas, I remember at that time you had Che Guevara and all the rest of it going on. They took that, those dollars, those petrodollars, and recycled them into loans into Latin America. I remember at the time I was doing consultancy work for a bank, and I saw these loans going through. It was almost always Citibank was leading the syndication. And typically it would be $100 million. I know it sounds peanuts now, but it's a lot of money in those days. $100 million syndicated loan for the state of Argentina or the nation of Argentina. And what was the purpose of the loan? To further the objectives of the state. That was the sort of phrase you got. Yeah. And we knew that 10% of it was going straight into the back pockets of the generals. Mm-hmm. I mean, would we ever get repaid? No way. But the fascinating thing about it was that even the small bank, it was a small consortium bank in London that I was working for at this stage, you know, doing this consultancy work, they couldn't say no. Why? Because they'd be cut off the list. Now, you know, a wise person would say, well, you know, is that, do you really want to be on that list? You know, the way banking worked was you didn't want to be cut out of a syndicated loan headed up by Citibank, Citicorp. So that was it. That was the basis of it. Now, that has now died. And I think that replacing the petrodollar as far as the Middle East is concerned, that is rapidly evolving into a petro-yuan. This is why one of the two Shanghai Gold Exchange vaults, which has now been opened outside China, outside mainland China, is in Saudi Arabia. That then becomes a collection point, if you like, for yuan in exchange for gold. You can deposit gold in there and get yuan out, or equally, you can put gold in there and get, or vice versa. So, that's pointing the way forward, because at some stage, it is clear that with that vault and also the Hong Kong one, Hong Kong being really China's offshore financial center, at any one moment, the Chinese can say, right, this is the rate. This is the rate at which yuan can be exchanged for gold for trade settlement purposes. I'm not talking about the domestic economy. I'm talking about trade settlement purposes. So that could be done overnight. I mean, it really could. And that's the way it's going. And of course, everyone in Asia knows that, which of course, again, makes them reluctant to hold excess dollars. Mm-hmm. So the dollar is, you know, it's got problems, certainly.
Alistair, you know, this seems like the perfect setup for gold to perform, right? Geopolitical risk, currency risk, possible massive inflation a la, you know, the 70s. Why do you think have the metals reacted the way that you expect they would in a situation like this?
It's an interesting question. I mean, basically what's happening is what's been going on for the last few decades is just accelerating. We think gold is too high. We think silver's too high. So we're selling it. And who's buying it? China. They're just filling their boots. Mm-hmm. There is a difference in the two stories. I mean, gold is one story and silver is another one. I mean, the interesting thing about silver, and I've just literally put out a note on my Substack about this, is that until 2024, China was supplying silver to the West, if you like, to global markets. And it was doing it in the region of sort of 3,500 to 4,000 tons a year. And it's been doing that for the last 5-6 years. I mean, without any doubt at all, the figures are there. You can see from, if you like, the customs figures out of China, that's what they've been doing. At the same time, there has been business the other way, and that is China has been importing silver, but in far, far smaller quantities. And then what happened in 2025 is that China turned around and stopped exporting debt. It just stopped. So suddenly, something like 4,000 tons of silver was no longer available to Western markets. And this is very, very important because Western demand has just been absolutely huge. The amount of silver which China actually produces out of its mines and also by refining non-ferrous metals, because something like 70% of silver comes out of sort of non-ferrous ores, amounts to less than what she's actually been supplying to the West. So she's been drawing down on her stockpiles. Why? In order to control the price. But she stopped doing that in 2025. Mm-hmm. Which is why everything exploded later on in the year. And particularly, I mean, we live with the myth, if you like, that, there was supply coming into the market and all the rest of it. We lived with that myth until September last year, when, provoked by the Americans, the Chinese turned around and said, right, no exports of rare earths, or we're only going to export rare earths to people who we want to. Which basically cut out the Americans and cut out the Europeans. What we didn't know at the time was they said exactly the same thing for silver. They'd already stopped exporting silver. Why they stopped exporting silver? Because they were drawing down on their own stocks to a point where it was uncomfortable. Who are the largest users of silver? China. They needed their own silver. Mm-hmm. And what we've seen, and there was a chart on Bloomberg, which has actually been sort of quite wildly circulated now. What we saw was that last year, China's imports of silver were around about 350, 60 tons, something like that. But then, and that was, without the exports on the other side. And then in this year so far, it exploded to 10 times. Last year's rate on an annualized basis. I mean, we've got something like 860 odd tons in the first 3 months of this year. And it's just taken everybody by surprise. Mm-hmm. What's happening basically is that China is just getting all the silver it can back into its own stocks. Now, what has driven this? I think there's a number of factors. I mean, one is that America has turned around and said, silver is a critical mineral. Well, is China going to supply the US with something that is determined as a critical mineral? It's not going to try and suppress the market or supply the market only to find it ends up in the US government stockpile. No. So that's one aspect of it. I think the other aspect is that demand in China is now accelerating so rapidly, really for the photovoltaic cell industry, that they need to hang on to what they've got. And they need to get what they can. And in fact, just 2 days ago, they told the photovoltaic cell manufacturers, slow down, which is an amazing thing to do, to tell your manufacturing industry, slow down. I mean, one's speechless, really. Mm-hmm. But you can see that this has got to be prompted by a stocks crisis. Now, having said it's a stocks crisis, I'm sure that silver, that China has got an awful lot of silver, don't get me wrong. But what she doesn't want to do in the current circumstances, with silver and other commodities being very, very cheap, with paper currencies going down the swanee, what she doesn't want to do is to lose control over her own stocks. Mm-hmm. So we have now a situation where not only is China deeming herself, the government deeming herself to be short of silver, but the rest of the world is as well. And, guess what? The other big manufacturer now, with virtually no silver, got to import virtually all of it, is India. because the Indian government, 2 years ago or thereabouts, decided that it needed to increase its production of photovoltaic cells to offset, if you like, the carbon footprint from all the coal-fired power stations, which they were building at the rate of something, I don't know, 40 or 50 a year. So that, so this is just a crisis now. And it's interesting because you've got some very, very good technical analysts like Mike Oliver, for example, who's saying that silver is going to moonshot. I don't think that was quite the word he used, but that's the effect of it. And you sort of look at it and think, you know, okay, Mike gets these things right. Why is he right? So I just felt I had to look at the underlying fundamentals, and that's what I came up with. And the answer is, yes, he is right. He's going to be right.
Yeah.
That there is very little doubt.
So in this situation, Alistair, do you think, or what do you think ends up being the catalyst for seeing a proper price reflection in gold and or silver in these tight markets and with the geopolitical risk being considered?
Well, it's the road to reality is not necessarily a straight road. I think that's the first thing I would say. What we're seeing, Tom, is we're not so much seeing gold and silver rising, though. You know, there's obviously an element of that because you get market squeezes and all the rest of it. But you're actually seeing the value of fiat currencies declining. By their value, I mean in terms of their purchasing power. So the way to look at it is actually, it's the fiat currencies that are in trouble, and that's what's driving everything. Now, of course, the investment community do not understand this. I mean, they see equities going up. They see bond yields stable, okay, higher than you'd like, but equities still seem to be rising and all the rest of it. So why panic? There's no panic. But there will come a point where, there's the debt trap element that begins to hit, and it'll be driven. Initially, anyway, it'll be driven by the inflationary consequences. I mean, by inflationary, I mean the consequences on consumer prices of what is going on in the Gulf today against a background of commodities which were already very, very cheap on long-term considerations. So this is a shock which, in a sense, mirrors what we saw when the Russians declared their special military operation against Ukraine in February 2022. You then had commodity prices suddenly shot up, prices of everything shot up, and the Fed and every other central bank, which had been suppressing interest rates for years, for decades, had to shift, if you like, and raise their interest rates. And you had the 10-year US Treasury yield hitting something like, I think, 4.8, 4.9%. This time it's going to go straight through it. And if you ask me whether it'll stop at 10, I'd say, I don't know. It might even overshoot that. Because I remember the 1970s. We were bailed out by the IMF. Who's going to bail out America this time? Mm-hmm. What, the IMF? Oh, dear. America owns the IMF. You can't have, you know, the son bailing out the parent in this case, that's for sure. So this is existential, this problem. And I think it'll be the rising bond yields which basically cracks everything. Mm-hmm. That will spur the Fed and its fellow G7 central banks into trying to suppress the rates in order to ensure that their economies don't collapse, and that will end up collapsing the value of their fiat currencies.
Well, Alistair, it's certainly a fluid and, as you say, interesting time, interesting road to reality here. And it's always a pleasure to get your take on how that happens and how we get there. Is there anything that you'd like our listeners to think about before we wrap up here today?
I think we've probably frightened them enough, haven't we?
Well, maybe to reiterate your point, understanding.
That was a bit serious. I mean, I've been very, very serious in this. I don't, you know, this is not a flippant subject. It really isn't. I think the only thing I would say is, you know, for goodness sake, if you value your wealth and try and protect it, then subscribe to my Substack, mcleodfinance.com. That's the only thing I can say.
Exactly. And of course, on X as well, you post kind of snippets of those articles at McLeod Finance there as well.
That's correct. Yeah.
Alistair, thank you so much for your time today. Always a pleasure.
That's my pleasure, Tom.